tech news moves fast, and often the articles we read and talk about on this show are just a few paragraphs, just a snippet of what's really going on with no context. That's why I was excited to snuggle up with my laptop and spend some quality time reading Harrison Weber's venture piece on the rise and fall of the dream of Project Aura, Google's modular phone. Welcome to the show, Harrison.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. Thanks for reading this piece, which is definitely worth reading. You write that Project Aura was a modular phone concept that at one point was supposed to start at $50. It was intended to give you the power to decide what your phone does, how it looks, where and what it's made of, how much it costs, and how long you'll keep it. That sounds fantastic, but your article talks about all the many reasons why this project failed. Let's start with the timelines to get to market. When and how did Project Aura start?
It started in 2012, in the summer of 2012, right when ATAP was Google's kind of innovation, like weird innovation lab, when it was started at Motorola. So back in 2012 was like the earliest kind of kernel of the idea, and quickly, you know, that, you know, a lot of time passed, and the public didn't hear about it until 2013. And then, you know, beyond that point, really, it was this project that was never supposed to be public. It was a secret project that was this interesting idea about customization back when the maker movement was something that everyone was really excited about. And then because of Dave Hawkins and this video called Phone Blocks came out, it kind of forced the project into the open, which became, you know, very defining factor of this product, this thing that was supposed to be secret and then ultimately became public too early. And maybe that was part of its downfall.
So Phone Blocks, this video was like a viral video about this modular phone concept. And Hawkins sort of had this idea that this would be maybe a decade worth of work. And meanwhile, ATAP was already working on this, and they really didn't want it to come out and say, have everyone say, look, you guys copied this guy in, you know, in his garage that had this idea. So they thought they would launch it. And then, really, it's not necessarily their fault. But then the time, I mean, you talk a lot about how they went faster than a lot of the developers were comfortable with, and it had a difference between going back and forth between Motorola and Google. And at one point, it really changed. I mean, at one point, it was a $50 phone. That was the idea, get this $50 phone into people's hands. When and why did that change?
It was a weird issue where this idea, at least if you look at it, if you step back, it's this kind of brilliant idea of building a phone out of high tech, kind of Lego blocks almost, and just sort of reality set in over time. And so, you know, this thing was going to come out in 2015, and it was going to cost $50. And then they realized, you know, that's just not possible. You can't really build a phone for $50. And this idea of building this massive ecosystem around these little tiny pieces, it just became too complicated. So slowly they started kind of making it a simpler and simpler idea until ultimately they made the modularity, these little pieces, just sort of like a fun add-on, which sort of got rid of the power of the project.
They had some of these really crazy, amazing ideas for these modules. Like, at first, like, they thought about, like, really big, like the one of the tardigrade is probably one of the coolest ideas ever, you know, where you have this little module where you can have these little tiny creatures in a microscope and you can follow them, and there'd be an app with that. Like, tell us some of the other cool, like, what, tell us about these modules.
It became, you know, the earliest idea was, all right, a phone can cost lots of different things. What if you made it so you could upgrade your screen, you could upgrade your battery? What if you only need a really big battery and you don't need a great camera because you just want a phone that lasts? And so at first it was functional and it was about compromises. And then they were like, all right, that's interesting, but only interesting to a small group of people. If we already have this flexibility, like, what could we do next? And it evolved into, you know, like checking your glucose levels, like a little module that could prick and measure, you know, like your blood, the sugars in your blood. There are things hidden in the videos. There are lots of little things like like almost like pre kind of paying with your phone credit card modules. There are just so many funny little ideas. The craziest one was putting this microscopic aquarium on your phone, which is from this, which was actually came up, Google commissioned this agency called Midnight Commercial to come up with the idea. And they're the ones who came up with it, not Google. But that was the one of the defining kind of ideas of like, what if we just put this in developers' hands and let them just do anything they want.
Well, so I'm spending a month. I usually use an iPhone exclusively. I'm spending a month using the Google Pixel, and I thought I would be really excited about all the choice, but it's daunting. And I think that is sort of the story, the real difference between Google and Apple. You know, it's like there's so much choice. It's like why McDonald's only keeps certain things on their menu? Too much choice can be exhausting. Do you think that is part of what happened to the Aura project?
Ultimately, you know, even in this conversation, this phone is kind of hard to explain. I mean, it's a, you can use metaphors, you can talk about Lego blocks, you can talk about, as I did, you can talk about never having to throw your phone away. But ultimately, we're talking about a bunch of little pieces of hardware that work together in a seamless way and building out this huge, massive, abstract ecosystem and hoping everything just sort of works. The problem is, and this is so enticing to developers, this is so enticing to the type of people who would maybe write about Google or would you know, obsess over Google or work at Google. But the average person, as Apple's proved, is really interested in something that works and does what you know, they mostly need in the, you know, throughout the day. And that's the problem with smartphones. You know, there's not a lot of innovation around anything but making them a little smaller over time. And that's why this just never, this project could have happened if one timeline didn't slip, or if two timelines didn't slip, if they hadn't fussed over, you know, the magnets that made it all connect in the back. Maybe if they were just a little ahead on their timeline, it could have just gotten out before it was axed. And if there was enough attention in the, you know, the consumer marketplace, you know, we would have maybe seen this developed for a couple more years by Google, since it was already out in the public's hands. But I think what they would have found no matter what is that this is just such a complex idea. No matter how cool or geeky or fun it is to talk about, it's just so the opposite of the iPhone. And the iPhone has pretty much everything going for it in terms of like what people want. And you know, that makes me almost a little sad, because it would be, it's kind of a boring space right now, the smartphone industry, where everything's very iterative. But it really is. There are already good products out there that do what people mostly need. And I think that's kind of would have been its downfall anyways.
So Regina Dugan was really Project Aura's champion from the beginning. Tell us about her role in this whole story.
So there were a bunch of little nuggets in this that I wasn't able to add to this story. So she was almost not hired by Dennis Woodside. And she sort of gave him this kind of speaks to her character. She gave him sort of an ultimatum when he told her that he wasn't going to hire her. The story that I heard was basically he said, you know, going with this person, this predictable person he was actually planning on hiring, was a nice way to, you know, to be safe. But what Dugan said to him was basically something to the effect of, you know, if you want to succeed, then you need to take a risk. And she's been this kind of really interesting character at Google for a few years. She's ex-DARPA, so the government agency responsible for doing these crazy kind of projects that pop up every now and then. She's basically kind of hell-bent on engineering crazy ideas as quickly as possible and then putting them in people's hands and seeing what happens, which is kind of what Google stood for a while. And now she's at Facebook building who knows what, and that's something I'd love to learn more about. But she's been very secretive there. But really, she's been the driving force behind this project and many other projects at Google. And with her gone from Google, you're just sort of – Google's starting to look a lot more like sort of a boring but mature kind of company than it was 5 years ago.
So now she's at Facebook and Project 8 or Building 8 or the mysterious – yeah. Which is, you know, it's a lot. It's similar to the moonshots program at Google, which seems to be being, you know, torn apart at this point. You know, they keep on dropping things. But, I mean, Building 8, we don't know anything that's going on there, right?
Exactly. It's very secretive. We know that they have, you know, 150 or so employees and you know, millions of dollars being thrown at whatever it is that Regina's building. But ultimately, this sort of speaks to the state of tech companies today. You know, it may be a little unfair to call Google boring. I mean, I think it's boring now compared to where it was 5 years ago. But really what we're looking at is, you know, Google's becoming kind of like Microsoft, and Facebook is in that space now. And even Facebook's maturing, and maybe we'll see a company like Snapchat, you know, go beyond just a few interesting projects and really become this kind of representation of new innovation.
Well, I think it's hard to talk about this without bringing up 3D printers and the maker movement. You talk all about that. They were doing research into tattoos at the beginning of Project Aura. And I mean, I think it's good to look at them side by side, because there was a moment a year, 2 years ago where everyone said, you know, there's going to be a 3D printer in everyone's home. Everyone's going to be a maker. And, you know, those movements are still around and they're still very important, but they're never going to be widespread. They're not going to most people in the United States will probably want to choose an iPhone over a modular phone that you can take things apart. They're, you know, people aren't going to have 3D printers and be printing their own pieces of their cell phones. Do you agree?
I do. I think that at least at this stage, in the way we define these things today, yes. Basically, you know, the way I'd put it is there was this exciting moment with 3D printers. There was, exciting moment with 3D had a moment. VR's having a moment now. I would love to see VR kind of become this thing that really takes hold and takes root in the mainstream. But, you know, VR could absolutely be like 3D TVs. It could absolutely be like early AR. It could be like 3D printers. I think the big thing is this was an era where hardware sort of reached a moment where things sort of felt, you know, felt kind of they were where they needed to be. And if you look at like the iPhone today, it feels a lot like it felt a couple of years ago. You know, that was a revolution, but it really has become this thing of, it's like the laptop. I mean, you know, other than making it a touchscreen, it's not transformative. So I think that everyone was sort of like, we reached this peak, and there'd been some time since the iPhone blew everyone's minds. And we were looking for this thing that was the next big thing. And modularity looked like it was going to be this transformative hardware movement, just like 3D printing looked like it was going to upend the way people, you know, the way manufacturing works. And I think now there's just not a lot to cling to. And that's why people are sort of looking at the remaining crazy things like VR and AR as the next big step. Because it doesn't look like modularity is going to be the thing, despite how cool of an idea it is.
It is so cool. It makes me so sad talking about, because like it was like the un-iPhone. Like, think about being able to have, you know, if you're a photographer, you can add more, you know, a larger camera or more. Like, it was like the opposite. And it's always sad for me when like innovation seems like everyone's on one stream. And so Project Aura kind of was like that thought of something that was really different, that people could, you know, look at things differently and you could end up getting whatever you wanted to that. It seems like you're saying they kind of were too innovative and they shot too far to that. And, you know, it saddens me to think that that means that we're not going to get any modularity on phones or something that's just really different and really innovative.
One funny thing that came out of reporting on this was that if you look at a lot of devices today, there's a sort of quiet hint of modularity. So even the iPhone, you can buy this battery case. I'm mostly paraphrasing one of the founders of Project Aura on this, just to credit him. But if you look at the iPhone, it's this like, there's this bumpy kind of battery case you can buy, and that's almost like a module that snaps onto the back. If you look at the Moto Z, they're experimenting it in a very, you know, a very gentle way if you compared to what ATAP and Google really imagined it would be. But the thing that I think this ultimately speaks to is, you know, right now the only thing that can transform your phone from it being like any other device is software. And software is the only way that developers can make this big change or innovate in a way that changes your experience on devices. And ultimately, all of our things, all of the things we do are kind of locked behind glass. And Aura was this idea, and just like 3D printing, of this physicality of innovation. I think that we may see that happen. But the thing about AR and VR is that's also about like digital things. And so it's kind of sad because I think hardware really had a moment. And, you know, some people are saying that things like PCs are getting interesting again, laptops are getting interesting again. The Verge said that recently at CES, but I just don't agree. I think that really we're kind of in a long plateau of you know, good, reliable, kind of boring hardware. And I'd love to see hardware get interesting. It hasn't really happened in a broad way. That's too bad.
And I mean, the closest thing to my phone becoming a transformer. I still have hope.
And we haven't even talked about the environmental aspect of this. I mean, we just think, well, this phone doesn't do what I want. I'm going to have to buy a new one. Whereas that was the promise of Aura as well. Like, you just switch a part out. You know, it's the same thing as fixing things, which we don't do anymore.
Yeah, it just, there's just so much to say about kind of what this could have been. The environmental stuff was a little bit of kind of the earliest element of Dave Hacken's goal, so phone blocks. And even in the earliest stages, that wasn't the point of what Google was doing or what Motorola was doing. And so that was always sort of, there's always some dissonance there. But I think it goes beyond in the environmental side, because this is like a device that you would never kind of buy again. You'd buy it once and you'd buy parts and you'd have a phone forever. Maybe not forever, but for a long period of time. And so it was upending everything. It was upending like the way hype works around phones. It would have rattled the whole industry. But if it didn't rattle the industry, no one was going to notice. And so it always had to be this crazy idea. It always had to have all these different elements, including the environmental side, which I think would have motivated a lot of buyers. But it's sort of an all or nothing deal. And that's kind of the way phones are. I mean, that's why phones are so designed to work for everybody. Instead of it being like, well, what if there's this great microphone because you're a musician, or what if you're a photographer? It just has to work for everybody. And I think that's kind of the most practical, financially, you know, makes sense, but very boring in terms of, you know, originality or character.
Well, thank you, Harrison, so much for joining us. I really enjoyed reading this piece. I think as tech journalists, sometimes we have two switches. It's like modularity is the next big thing. Modularity is dead. And your piece really talks about everything that happens in between. And if you're not working on a book, I think you ought to. So that's it was a great read. Harrison Weber is the executive editor at VentureBeat. You can read the story and follow him on Twitter. He's at Harrison Weber. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.